So tonight, this is the seventh week of this 9-week course. We're continuing to look at pieces of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And tonight we're going to look at something called the five aggregates of clinging, which to my mind is probably the most difficult of all of the Buddha's teachings to grok. And that might just be me. Other people think, oh, well, of course. So I want to mention a few things before I get into the details. One is that in the Samyutta Nikaya, Samyutta means collected, so the collected discourses of the Buddha, which is sort of sections on various topics. The biggest section by far is the section on the five aggregates of clinging, which I think that's interesting. It's like there's actually 159 unique suttas about this particular topic. So it's something the Buddha really emphasized quite strongly, more than any other topic. So the Pali word for aggregates, that we call it the five aggregates, it's the five khandhas. So khanda, in Sanskrit, if you're familiar with Sanskrit, you'll see skanda, which is the same word. Literally, when you translate that, it means heaps. So piles of stuff. And heaps is a good word in that it implies sort of randomness or messiness. These are just like a heap of things, or a heap of mental formations or whatever. And the reason this is called the five aggregates of clinging, particularly, is that these are the things that we cling to, that we hold on to, that we use to repeatedly create a sense of a separate self. Which is why the Buddha spent so much time talking about this, because this is the central issue in the Buddha's teachings. We have this, this idea that we're somehow ultimately separate, as opposed to all connected together. And so that's why there's so much emphasis that the Buddha places on this in his teachings. And remember, clinging is the cause of suffering, the second noble truth, tanha, clinging, which causes suffering. This is how we create our own difficulties over and over and over again. I want to just read the sutta. The sutta is actually quite simple. This is the actual instructions for meditation. He knows, such is material form, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is feeling tone, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is cognition, such its arising, such its passing away. Such are volitions, such their arising, such their passing away. Such is consciousness, such its arising, such it's passing away. That's it. That's the entire. And I want you to notice that once again we're talking about not only seeing things arise, but equally seeing things pass away. Because a lot of what he's trying to do in this particular part of the instructions is to make us see the impermanence of everything. And since it's impermanent, why are we clinging to them? Because they're not going to last anyway, and we're bound to suffer when they disappear. So here's the five aggregates again. First one is material form, which is basically anything. Anything that we can perceive with our senses, and the sense impressions themselves are all the first aggregate. So it's like our whole experiential physically experiential world and all the stuff in it. That's the first aggregate. Pretty big, messy pile, right? Second one is Vedana, which we've oh, we've come. Here's our friend Vedana again. We talked with this, you know, back when we talked about the second foundation of mindfulness. Well, here it is again. So this is another central part of the Buddha's teachings. So this is that mental formation of that has only three forms that arises whenever we experience something in the material world. Whenever we experience form, then Vedana arises. So this one thing leads to another in this teaching, right? Vedana arises, and it's, remember, it's either pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's it. It's a very simple, subtle, almost instantaneous mental formation that arises whenever there's contact to anything in the material world. I'll come back to that more. But then the third one is, in the sutta, the translation is cognition. We've also seen it translated as perception. And this is sort of the next phase that always goes on. Something arises. The Vedana arises. The pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling. And then perception or cognition arises. And that's basically the mental function we have that categorizes and figures something out. Oh, that sound I just heard that's so pleasant, that was a blue jay, because that's what blue jays sound like, and I know it. You know, it's, and so this is the process, the mental process, where we learn over time what all these different things, you know, that we store away, like that's what a blue jay sounds like. Then we hear it, and we know, oh, that's a blue jay. And that's the process of perception functioning. Perception is go into the memory banks. What the heck was that? Oh, that was a blue jay. And we do this, once again, almost automatically. This is just something that happens. And then we have what's sometimes called the fourth one. Sometimes mental formations in the broadest sense. And notice that we've separated out already two mental formations. Vedana and perception have been separated out as being so important that we take them out of the pile, in a sense. And this is, sometimes you'll see this talk about as volitions or intentions. These are two things that get highlighted in this particular discussion, but in a broad sense. So all thoughts and emotions, accepting Vedana and perception. So that's another pretty broad, messy category. Like everything that we think of as thinking, thoughts and emotions, moods, that's all in this fourth heap. And then the fifth heap is consciousness, awareness, the sense of knowing. So it's not like perception, which is like a raw knowing. You know, we perceive something, then we start thinking about it, and then consciousness has arisen, essentially. These are all these five are all intermingled and happening. But consciousness is separated out as a separate mental formation. And basically, the idea is that if we can see that everything we can possibly experience falls into one of these five heaps, and we can see that things are just arising and passing away, which is what the instructions say. Notice when things arise, notice when things pass away. Then we see, oh wait, there's no self in there. There's no I. anywhere. It's just stuff arising and passing away at these various levels. But that's all that's ever happening. When we start to really look at it from this particular angle, remember, you know, these things, that the Dhammas in the fourth foundation are really, here's a way to look at your experience. In this particular way, we start to see, no matter what it is that's happening, there's no self there. There's no I in any of these things. They're just things that arise and pass away. And we start to understand, slowly, probably very slowly, that this sense of a separate I is just delusional thinking. You know, the sense of a separate I is just, we like the idea of having this separate self, and I'll talk a lot more about that as, you know, the evening goes on. But really what we're seeing is we're seeing that whatever we're noting, as we note these things as they arise, they all pass away. There's no exception to that. The total impermanence of everything, even consciousness. You know, just things arise and then they're gone. That's the nature of everything. And but this is a way of clearly seeing it from this, taking this particular viewpoint or this particular angle. So let's look a little more closely at this. So material form is one way of thinking of this, is anything that can be affected by external conditions, heat, cold, wet, dry, etc. Anything that falls into that category is it has material form. So there's no mental part to this. This is physical stuff that is subject to nature. You know, things are getting hot and cold and wet and dry and all those various things that things do. And the physical sensations we experience, because we experience heat, cold, wet, dry, right? I touch my head and, you know, still a little hair up there, and it's like, oh, it's fuzzy. Right? All I'm doing is I've just perceived my head and attached something to it, but it's like, that's everything that can be experienced through the five senses. That's this material form. Then we have Vedana, feeling tone. You know, when we talked about Vedana a lot a couple of weeks ago, when we were talking about, you know, the second foundation of mindfulness. So any arising of material form at one of the sense doors is followed by Vedana. We're aware of something, we notice something, we note it, and then Vedana is right there. And we can note the Vedana as a separate mental arising. And the important thing here is, sometimes if we're not careful, we start solidifying Vedana. Oh, I always like that thing. And we start conflating that physical experience with the Vedana as one thing. I always like that thing. I always dislike that thing. Who cares about that thing? You know, all three responses, right? But really, Vedana is separate from the material object itself. So, you know, and the example one of my teachers used to use is, imagine someone gave you something you really like to eat. And you eat it and you really enjoy it. And so the Vedana, the very experience of all those sensations of eating, are all very pleasant. And just as you finish, they give you another one. Now eat this. And the second one is like, eh, not so exciting. You know, I had enough already, but, you know, my teacher gave me this, I better eat it. So you sort of struggle through. But, and so by the end of the second time, it's like pretty neutral. Pretty like, oh God, that's enough of that. And then just at that moment, they hand you a third of the same thing. And it's like, ugh, same object, exactly the same object. Three different vedanas depending on causes and conditions. What happened just before, which is what causes and conditions really are. What happened before something created this particular moment, and it's those causes and conditions that sort of flavor the vedana that I experience. So vedana is totally unreliable in terms of solidity. It changes based on what's happened just before, on causes and conditions such that existential experience arose. Totally unreliable. And it's just like everything else that arises and passes away. Then there's perception or cognition. And part of this is interesting is that as human beings we think, well, I know what I saw. You know, ask any police officer who interviews a bunch of people after, you know, some crime has been committed and there were some witnesses. And they'll get like five different descriptions of the same perp. Because people perceive things differently based on their own biases and their own ideas. And they're, well, only that kind of person would do that kind of thing. So they have that idea. Then they describe the person like one of those people, whatever those people are, right? So perception is different for everyone, number one. We all perceive things differently. It's not accurate. And it's something that we learn. Remember I said perception is based on the idea that something arises and then we go off into our memory banks and find something just like that and say, oh, that's what that was. Well, the problem with our memory banks is we don't have experiences of everything. We have only the experiences we've had ourselves. And sometimes those things we remember are pretty inaccurate, to say the least. We remember something and you ask someone else who was at the same event and they'll remember something totally different. Once again, based on our druthers. And also we think that somehow perception is, well, just there. Right? There's an interesting story, you know who probably know who Oliver Sacks is. And Oliver Sacks had this really interesting experience where he was working with this team of people, and this man who had never been able to see since he was born. And then they've discovered some way to operate on his optic nerves somehow, and he was going to be able to see. It was great. And so they do the operation, and his eyes are all covered in pads. And now it's the big moment. They're going to take off the things over his eyes, and he was going to see for the first time. And they're all excited that he was going to get to see, right? His partner was right there. He knew his partner, having had a partner for a number of years, but had never been able to look at her. So they take off the patches, and there his eyes are opening. And it's clear that his eyes are functioning and, like, you know, they can see, you know, movement and that sort of stuff. But he freaks out because he can't see anything because he has no memory. He's just seeing patterns of light and dark and color and nothing else because he has no perceptual memory of what that combination of light and color, which happens to be his wife's face, is. He doesn't know that because he hasn't learned it yet. So perception is a learned process. It's individual. And it's based on our memories, and our memories are totally unreliable. And also, what we do is like we'll hear something or see something, taste something, and we'll go into our memory bank and we'll say, oh, that's what that was. But often that memory is not accurate at all. You know, or that perception is not accurate. You know, there's some thing, long and thin line on the path right ahead of us as we're walking along, and our mind goes, "Oh my God, it's a snake." And then we get closer and we realize it's just a piece of cord that was lying on the road, on the path. But standing back a bit, we perceived it to be something else and believed that that's what it was. And we might even have reacted, "Oh my God, a snake," and we started to run away before we just looked at it and went, "Oh, it's just a piece of old rope lying there." We do this all the time. You know, I catch myself, you know, just walking along, looking at things, and I'll think, "Oh, look, that's a person over there." And then I get a little bit closer, and I see it's just a sort of a pillar of rocks, and it's sort of shaped with the top of it, a little indentation where a neck would be. This happened to me a couple of days ago, and I was sure it was a person until I got close on it. Then I know it's just a pile of rocks. But my mind went, "Oh, that's a person over there. What's that person doing there?" You know, sort of off the path a little bit. And sure enough, total misperception, totally unreliable. Without it, we couldn't function in the world. So thank God we have perception. It would be very difficult. I mean, this man who was blind for like 30 years before he could see, he never really was able to function very successfully getting around in the world, because he didn't have enough of a memory of events over that he'd recorded for the first 30 years of his life to sort of fit things together. He never really could see things that clearly to the point where he would know what things were. Okay, so that's perception. Then we get what's called, you know, mental formations, sometimes called volition or intention. And this is where we use language, number one. We use language to describe things, right? And we make a sense of I by the language we use, mentally or verbally, about these mental formations that arise. You know, I am happy, I am sad. Well, who's the I that's happy or sad? You know, it's not. You know, and so part of the, and I've seen this instruction in several different situations when I'm with different teachers. We have to learn to somehow go, say, happiness has arisen, sadness has arisen. So there's no, we don't have any mental I in the question, in the equation. At least not verb. We don't have that word I there. I had another teacher who suggested you try and spend a whole day, just one day, without ever using the words I, me, or mine. It's quite astonishing how often we use those words in conversation and, you know, in our mental things and what we're writing, what we're typing, whatever. We use them over and over and over again. And it's like we're creating this sense of something solid. That's me, right? And volition or intention are particularly important because they give the idea, they add another layer of charge to this sense of I-ness and minus I-creating. Or volition and intention give rise to the idea, I'm in charge. Not only is there an I, but I'm the I that's in charge. You know, which creates another layer of attachment and clinging to the idea, because I'm in charge. Thank goodness, you know, I'm in charge. And this is really easy to see when you look at physical actions. So just want you, wherever you are now, just put your hand on a flat surface and close your eyes. And just tune into what's going on. What are you actually experiencing in that in this moment by shifting your concentration to what's happening right now with that hand on that surface. And what's almost always happening is, oh, there's my hand on my desk. Two things, something I possess and me, right? But really all that's ever happening when you get way back to the very beginning is a bunch of physical sensations. And we like or dislike them, we get the vedana, and then perception arises, and perception and mental volitions blend together to create my hand. Because I know that that combination of physical sensations means there's a hand there, and it's mine. That's my hand, not somebody else's hand. Somebody else's hand on top of mine feels very different than my hand, right? So we keep creating this sense of a separate self by how we think about and how we tune into what's arising and how we self-describe what's actually happening. So once again, this is a mental habit that we somehow need to note. Oh, there I am, selfing again. That's what the Buddha is pointing to. He's pointing to, can I see not only that the idea of that a hand has arisen, but that's, can I also see that that's how I'm just creating a false sense of a separate self, that really all that's there is pure sensation, nothing more. And we build out of that this sense of my hand on the desk. And we do this over and over and over again. And once again, thank goodness we do, because it's pretty hard to function in the world if you don't know where your hands are, right? But in the world of relative reality, boy, we're really glad we have perception, and we're really glad we have the sense of putting things together in this way. So we know where the edges of our body are compared to other bodies or other objects. But in absolute reality, when we look at it, we see that it's just an idea in our mind, nothing more than that. That really all that's there is this raw perception process. Then we come to consciousness, the fifth of the khandhas. So this is the trickiest one, and I will do my best to explain it, but something I still struggle with myself, to be honest with you, but we'll talk about that more in a minute. But this is, consciousness is that function that knows. Yeah. We identify with this aggregate because it seems continuous. There's somewhere in all of this process, there's this solid thing called consciousness that I have. Ah, there's I again, right? But really, consciousness is just the mental process that arises for a moment when something arises at one of the sense doors. And then it's gone. But it seems like consciousness is always there because we're having so many moments of consciousness all the time. It never stops. And it seems like this is one long continuous thing, but in another teaching, the Buddha talks about having eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, different forms of consciousness that arise based on what sense door is operating. And what he's pointing to is that really what's happening is there's a little moment of consciousness, and then there's another one over here, but it's might be in a totally separate kind of consciousness, different flavor, based on what sense organs were involved. But because it's going on so continually, we start to see that not only is it going on continually, but it keeps changing. It never rests on any one particular thing. It's just something that arises based on, you know, something that's happening, way, you know, something that arose due to causes and conditions back there in the world of formations, of forms. Consciousness arises, then it's gone. Then something else arises, a bit more conscious. But it's just, it's continually changing all the time. It's not solid, it's not there. And there's no, when you try and look at it, like, well, where is that? You know, you can't locate it. You know, it's, you know, people say, well, it's off up here in my brain someplace, or maybe it's in my heart, or maybe it's external to me, but it's sort of like my aura or something. They're all like explanations people give to try and sort of make it mine. It's in my heart, it's in my brain, it's in my aura. But my all the time. Once again, creating a sense of a separate self at this more quite abstract level. Even, you know, we even sometimes think of that consciousness as sort of like this observer that sort of sits back and notices everything that's going on. That's why my consciousness is this observing process. But it's just, it observes this and then this and then this and then this and never stops, and it keeps changing all the time. There's no solidity to it at all. I'm going to share something. This is a book called Emptiness by Guy Armstrong. And there's a really interesting section here where he's talking about this sense of making a separate I in the context of the five aggregates. Guy's quite an intellectual. This has some sort of dense intellectual part to it, but at the same time it's quite brilliantly clear, I think, anyway. In many discourses, the Buddha suggests to his disciples not to claim the five aggregates as self or belonging to self. Here is a representative teaching, one that occurs in a few discourses. The Buddha is addressing a group of practitioners. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Dutiful monks reply, impermanent, venerable sir. In what is impermanent, suffering or happiness? Suffering, venerable sir. In what is impermanent, suffering and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, venerable sir, dutiful monks reply. So this is an interesting list, and that's what he said. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. These are three separate flavors, in a sense, of selfing, of creating a sense for a separate self, by claiming something, it belongs to you, claiming that this is who you are, or that myself is contains this thing, or I'm contained in this thing, whatever this thing is, right? He goes on. We need to explain the uses of the word suffering and happiness in this discourse. Suffering is the translation of the Pali word dukkha, a significant term in the Buddhist teachings that actually has a broader range of meaning than simply suffering. It covers the whole spectrum of what we might call the unfortunate aspects of living. We can range from a mild sense of incompleteness or a state of irritation to the most intense experiences of bodily pain and mental anguish. Because some pain is inherent in living, the Buddha characterizes the life of the senses as not entirely satisfactory. as dukkha. It is the lack of satisfaction that leads us, most of us, to a spiritual path. We all got here today because at some level we understand this. In Buddhism, the entire goal of the spiritual life is to end this sense of unsatisfactoriness by finding an unshakable peace called nibbana. The word unsatisfactoriness is now a much more common translation of the word dukkha. So suffering is too negative. It has a negative vibe to it. Where unsatisfactoriness is, yeah, it doesn't work. Right? The word translated as happiness in the Pali term sukha, which we also has connotations of pleasure and contentment. In this passage, in contrast to dukkha, means that we should consider happiness to point to a lasting happiness that would remove any underlying unsatisfactoriness. Therefore, to bring out the full meaning of the Pali, we might translate the Buddha's second question as, is what is impermanent ultimately unsatisfying, or can it lead to lasting happiness? And the practitioner's then response, ultimately unsatisfying, Venerable Sir. The Buddha is not saying that all the sense experience is miserable or that there is no happiness or pleasure in life. Far from it. In many discourses, he talks directly about the pleasures that can be found through the senses. However, he also states clearly that sense pleasures can only give limited fulfillment. They cannot overcome the basic unsatisfactoriness of conditioned life caused by its changing nature. Now he goes on to this last sentence. Each of the phrases used in the third question is significant. This is mine expresses ownership. We own things, first of all, because we desire them or some aspect of them. Because of the underlying motivation of desire, we become attached to those things. We've invested emotional energy into them, remaining the way they are now. When they change or are broken or decay or die, as inevitably they will, we'll suffer because the attachment will be broken too. This is the basic cycle of which the Buddha is pointing. Ajahn Chah, a great forest master of Thailand in the 20th century, described this well, referring to a glass of water that he was drinking from. You can say, don't break my glass. Can you prevent something that's breakable from breaking? If it doesn't break now, it will break later on. If you don't break it, someone else will. And if someone else doesn't break it, one of the chickens will. Whenever you use this glass, you should reflect that it is already broken. Develop this kind of understanding. Use the glass. Look after it until one day it slips off your hand. Smash. No problem. Why is there no problem? Because you saw its brokenness before it broke. Can we have that sort of relationship to our stuff? Is what he's pointing to here. The activity of attachment, also called clinging or grasping, is born from desire and is the root of an unsatisfactory relation to life. Ownership is rooted in craving. The second phrase, this I am, points to the activity of identification. We feel I am this body. I am angry. I am the observer. When the body is threatened, I am threatened. If our emotions are criticized, I am at risk. People point out that in the epigraph at the start of this chapter, conflict comes when we assert I am this because this is always changing and hence unreliable. Identification is imagining that I'm a particular fragment of what exists, which is limited, bound to decay, and bound to decay. This is a simply way of conceiving of self. You can say it is actually a form of conceit, a technical term indicating the deep tendency to take oneself to be something. The third phrase, this is myself, is similar to the second phrase, but leads in a slightly different direction. This is myself means that we have a particular view about the self, about where I reside. At the time of the Buddha, Indian society was crowded with philosophical and religious teachers and sects, all promoting their own opinions and arguing against each other. Many of these views had to do with what defined the self. Unlike, say, political views, a view about the self is at the center of our very existence and can shape our life in strong ways. If the view is incorrect, we may live our entire life in an illusion. In addition to consciously adopted philosophical stance, such a view may also include beliefs about the self that we've taken on without noticing. And this, you know, we have this idea that we're separate from, like, our culture. Our culture, that's what our culture teaches us, that we're different than, you know, we all have our own, we're all unique and different, and we all have our own way of being and things of that nature. So this is, the thing I want to point out here is this, as I said, this is not an easy topic to take in. And I'll talk more about that after we see it. But from the point of view of practice, one thing that's suggested is that as you're noting things, can you actually note this underlying process? Causes and conditions arise, something arises at one of the sense doors, Vedana arises, can we see that? Then perception, can we see that? Then the mental process around it starts, you know, the stories start arising, and then we have this idea that somehow I'm seeing this or understanding this or whatever layer of consciousness we're identifying with. But can we see that if we start to really pay attention, we see that everything that we see, everything at any one of these levels, in any of these heaps, just arises and passes away. That's what we're trying to learn to do. Because once we can do that, we start to see that this sense of separate self is delusional. It isn't true in any sense of the word, in the absolute sense of the word. It's just a conglomeration of ideas and memories and perceptions and things that we take to be solid and that we consciously solidify in our mind because it feels safe to have something solid. And that's really what it comes down to. We want things to be solid because then we have some solid basis on which we exist. And what the Buddha is pointing to here is very difficult to take in, and we'll talk more about that later, because it's undermining how we've always believed things are from when we can remember anything. We think, well, of course, this is me. This is me here, and this is you guys over there. And we're trying to break that down in this way, consciously break it down. Okay. So, that, now we're going to sit for half an hour. Well, maybe, let's just sit for about 20 minutes, because I have a few more things I want to say. This is one of those topics that I could talk about for 3 days. I'm trying to reduce it to less than an hour. It's like, So let's just sit for about 20 minutes, and I'll have a few more things to say afterwards. I want to read a little bit of the sutta to you. So if you're listening to this recording, this is when there's going to be a little pause, a blank recording, which when you return your recording off, sit for half an hour, or however long you want to sit, and then turn the recording back on to get the rest of the class. So let's settle in. Be comfortable. Be focused. Just don't make this a huge project, like, oh, I better just see the skandhas and nothing else. But sometimes it's like, oh, that's what that one was. Now that we have this framework, we can start to see things arising within the context of this framework a little bit. Especially if we set the intention to do that. And then just be still. So, I want to share a few other little tidbits. One is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. Where he's talking about this, the five aggregates of clinging. There are many instances in the discourses where people would hear these teachings and either become fully enlightened or, if not, ripe for their final awakening, have the cloudless, stainless vision of the Dhamma arise in the mind, turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what is hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyes to see. It's a description of the process. When we bring the teachings of the five aggregates into the realm of direct experience, they lead us into a profound investigation of what is called life. These teachings open up new levels of understanding, similar to and even more transformative than the great discoveries of the atom or the quantum realities that underlie our conventional perceptions of the world. The teachings on the aggregates directly point to those realities underneath the surface appearance of self or I or being. Through this investigation, we begin to discover who we really are. Or, the more important, actually, I should be careful here. He actually says what we really are. Who implies something separate, in a sense. By what we really are. It's just an interesting way of looking at things, right? Now I want to read a couple little bits of sutta, just because, like I said, there are 159 suttas on this topic. I just want to read you little bits of a few of them. Bhikkhus, I will teach you the burden, the carrier of the burden, the taking up of the burden, and the laying down of the burden. And the burden is something we carry, right? And what, bhikkhus, is the burden? It should be said, the five aggregates subject to clinging. So it's the five aggregates themselves are the burden, right? So long, bhikkhus, as I do not directly know as they really are, the gratification as gratification, the danger as danger, and the escape as escape, in the case of these five aggregates subject to clinging, I did not claim to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world. But when I knew all this as it really is, then I claim to have awakened. So this is what he had to see more than anything else to become an awakened being. And in another sutta, he says, you know, even there he was sitting under the Bodhi tree. He's describing that experience. And he said, and the last thing he had to let go of was the subtle sense of a separate self. So this isn't something that, oh well, we'll take care of this tomorrow, you know. this is the core of the practice at this sort of almost existential level. This is where the work is, and it takes time. And that's just, it's unfortunate, but we have to deal with that. Or maybe it's fortunate that the Buddha expressed it clearly enough that we see that we have to deal with it. Here's another thing, though, and I think this is also quite interesting. Here, Bhikkhu, the uninstructed worldling becomes frightened over an unfrightening matter. For this is frightening to the uninstructed worldling. I might not be, and it might not be for me. I will not be, and I will not be for me. Always seems like, oh my God, if that is it, if there's no me here, what's left? This is a fear we have to get over dealing with these teachings. Is we have to get past the, I don't want this. This is too scary, because if there's no me, separate self, me, what is there? And it's like clinging to a sense of a separate self. It's the last layer of clinging that we have to learn to work with. I'm not making any claims that I've anywhere close to doing that. But just that's where the work is. Is this idea that we have to stop doing this, but it's so scary that we don't want to go anywhere near it. In another place, Joseph has this image he uses where we just jump out of an airplane, you know, we're doing parachute diving, you know, skydiving, and we're flying through the air, and oh, it's great. And then we realize, oops, we forgot to put our parachute on. And then we're really frightened, of course. Oh my God, I don't have a parachute. I'm flying through the air, and what's going to happen? And then you realize there's no ground. There's nothing separating you from everything you're experiencing in that moment. There's no ground to crash into. It's just what's being experienced in this moment, and then the next moment, and then the next moment. That sense of I'm going to crash is just conceit, an idea that we form of who we are and what's going to happen. Nothing more than that. And then there's this wonderful poetic expression of these ideas. This is from Dana Fall's book, Go In and In. And it's a really simple, beautiful poem. It's called Touch Me. Touch me as if you seek to find the core of my desire. Come to me like wind before a summer storm. Blown open, I close no doors against the breeze. Dance with me beneath the low clouds. Find me within you, above you, beside you. When the rain finally falls, I cannot tell where you end and I begin. That's where we're heading carefully and slowly towards. I cannot tell where you end and I begin. So that's all I have to say. So I want to sort of, as I always do, open the floor to comments, questions, thoughts, sharings. And as always, I'll say, don't feel at all obliged to say anything. Or this is pretty dense stuff, and it's something that we have to sort of cogitate on, look at, see if we can see little glimmers of it in our meditative experience itself.
I think precisely because it's so dense, I am also very drawn to this topic and could probably talk and think about it endlessly. But I was, and you've already brought up a number of books tonight. A question that kind of came into my mind as I was meditating was about any other like books or media whether from Joseph Goldstein, who I remember you had mentioned in a previous session, was a teacher of yours, or anyone else. Joseph Goldstein is actually the first person that I was introduced this concept from, just on a podcast I had listened to where he was being interviewed. But you've already kind of done that. But if there are any others, I would love to.
Well,
Maybe I should email you.
yeah, no, Natalie, I mean, I would really suggest, and this is, it's a very dense philosophical book, but if you like that sort of thing, you'll love this. It's called Emptiness, A Practical Guide for Meditators by Guy Armstrong, who was my
Oh,
friend.
is that what you would
I also read
read
from this
from?
today. Now, this,
Okay.
he was my principal teacher for 10 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so
Wonderful.
I can I ha don't hesitate to mention him. This is simply called Emptiness by Guy Armstrong.
Thank
Actually,
you so much.
the
Yeah.
foreword's by Joseph Goldstein, by the way.
Oh.
Guy is one of Joseph's principal students.
Okay, I see.
So it's all related, connected.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Margo, you've had your mic on for a while there.
Hi. Yeah, there were a couple of things that kind of caught my attention that in my mind seemed to contradict the idea of no self. And so I wanted to see what you thought. You know, the first is like the first four of the aggregates are very self-focused, right? Like material form. So it's what you're experiencing in the physical world. And then Vedana is very much yours, right? Like, what is, are you
Okay.
deeming this pleasant?
Well, okay, let me stop you right here. The problem is the language we use to explain these things.
Yeah.
The language in and of itself, that's my experience, that's my Vedana, that makes them seem like they're mine and separate, but they're just stuff that's happening.
But the way it's perceived is different. Like if I perceive, like you brought up a great thing. You're like, okay, if something is hot, let's say, you know, I'm in the rainforest, it's a hot day. I experience the hot, and then to me, you know, let's say you and I are in the rainforest with a group. To me, the hot may be very unpleasant, but you may like heat. And so for you, the Vedana may be, you know, something different. So that's why I'm saying it just, it feels individualistic. Do you know what I
Yeah,
mean?
it's. I have to point again to the language, where
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
experience it one way and you experience it. Now you've just created, not,
Yeah.
two separate selves. And the problem with language is that it always ends up here. It always ends up in this dualistic world, because that's the nature of language.
Right. Yeah.
And
Maybe
So
they'll
we're
think.
trying to explain something that's non-dual using a dualistic form.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can't get around that.
Yeah.
And neither can, people who write brilliant books for that matter. There's always like, as soon as we get into the world of language, language is by its very nature self, not self. So we're trying to use an imperfect tool to explain something that's there.
Yeah.
And so all of what I can do and what other teachers can do, I think, is point us towards something. Like, here's something you might experience, and when you experience it, if you can fit it into this perceptual world, this idea, this concept, and see how it fits, and then see the arising and disappearing nature of it, then that will lead you to something that is an understanding that's separate from the idea of a self. I wish I could explain it better than that,
No,
but.
that it makes sense. I understand what you're saying. Language, at least our language, like English, the English language is very
All
focused
languages.
on me, mine, our, you know.
Yeah, but all languages like that. All language has those concepts of me, not me. Built into the language, because language is the way we navigate the world. And God forbid we should have no language. Just like we shouldn't, God forbid we should not have perception. Would start walking into walls and not understanding where the edge of our body was compared to other people's bodies. All these things are essential in the world of relative reality. We couldn't function without them. And what the Buddha is talking about and trying to get us to see is, yes, in the world of relative reality, that's all true. But in the world of absolute reality, that sense of a separate self is just delusionary. Yeah, and it's something we can't figure out. It's something we have to experience. There I am, we and I. Here I am using pronouns again, right? Because that's language. Hopefully that helps a little bit, at least.
It does. The other thing I'll say is, around consciousness, a lot of times, we talk about the collective consciousness or the individual consciousness. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, these are philosophical ways of looking at this, yeah.
Yeah.
But,
Again, it is language, I
yeah.
understand.
And it's also particular philosophy. The idea of collective consciousness arose out of certain philosophical systems, like Carl Jung, for instance.
Okay. Which may not follow the Buddhist philosophy
Who
is what you're
may be
saying.
totally. And I'm not saying they're wrong, they're just different.
Got it.
Jung
Okay.
is, if you read Jung, which I read a lot of Jung at one time in my life, I was really, he's brilliant, but he has his certain view of things. And you can see where, in some ways, he's sort of the same thing, similar to what the Buddha says, but using different words in different language. Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Anything else, or have we exhausted you all at this point? Let's just dedicate the merit for practice.
Does Scotty have his hands up?
No, Scotty didn't have his mic on. He's had his usual Scotty smile on his face, that's all. Okay. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.